And it, you know, it's a mental discipline for a kid to be able to, you know, proceed, or it was for me.
Being an absolute carnivore, I never had that disconnect.
Okay.
Si, I think it's been months since we put a video and updated our audience with what you've been up to. So maybe right off the bat, what have you been up to over the last 6 months? We've been doing the Spec House. What's been keeping you busy?
Well, I've been doing lots of knives. I'm trying to get quite a few of them done before Christmas. Just shipped two today, shipped two a couple days ago.
I've got stateside, do you remember addresses? Anything spectacular there?
One went to Arizona, two went down into the Los Angeles area. One went back east, I can't remember where.
You shipped something to Israel like 2 months ago, didn't you?
Actually, they didn't go to Israel. A guy is in Israel at bottom, but he had them shipped up to Issaquah, Washington. Because he bought a new Chevy four-wheel drive pickup, and he's having it tricked out, and he's going to tour up through into Alaska and then maybe down through the United States, Canada, Mexico, South America. I don't know where he's going, but it's quite a trip.
Hey, tell him to stop by.
He thinks he might. He might stop and see the Forge. I bought a 34 Ford Model BB 10.5 truck. It was in Montana. A couple friends and I went back and got it. And I hope after the first year I get to work on it a little bit. I've got the motor running. It runs, sounds good. I've done a little bit of body work on it, but I just haven't had time to really.
Is that the original motor in it?
No, it's not. It's a later flathead V8, probably about 1950 model, somewhere in there. It's not the 59 AB that I was so familiar with when I was hot rodding. But
the last time you rebuilt something like this, you were like in your early 20s and you were building a Model T or something.
No, I was 17.
17.
Actually, 16 to 17. That was a flathead Model A motor that I'd hopped up and did a whole bunch of stuff to. Turned 96 1/4 with it, which isn't too bad in the 50s.
One of the first videos we put up, Si, that featured you was the a video of butchering one of your cows. This was probably 3 or 4 years ago. And that video still gets a lot of views, and it's really great. I was watching it the other day. It's just really neat. It's beautiful, and there was a nice day, and the cattle are all kind of just cruising around in the high speed. So anyways, that video continues to get views. There's some recurring comments there. What stands out to you, having looked through those comments probably over, you know, once or twice? How do you answer some of the questions people have that have showed up there?
Well, I haven't seen it for a long time, but it was interesting to see the broad spectrum of the comments, from "Hey, way to go! I wish I could do that." To "Yeah. Oh my God, you're killing that poor animal!" and
you in killed front of
her.
Friends.
You killed her in front of her
in
friends.
Front of her friends and family.
You know, when you shoot something like that, the rest of them mill around. They come and look at it, and then they go away and eat. You know, it's not a. I don't think there's any trauma involved there, although they do know that something's different, and they will smell that sight, and if you leave the hide laying there, the head laying there, they'll come and sniff it. Sometimes they chew on the bones and
paw out a little bit sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially the bulls. They'll put their heads down and scoot around on the blood and the stuff.
We tend to... What's the word? Anthropomorphize, you know, assign human characteristics,
right,
and give names. And,
yeah.
And, but there is no anthropomorphizing the result from the cow's perspective. I mean, they startle, the herd jumps when the gunshot goes off and their heads come up and their ears go forward and they look around as sort of an immediate you know, part of their fight or flight response. It's an unexpected sound, but they don't associate that sound with anything that could happen to them.
I don't think so. And then they go back to eating,
yeah,
you know?
Right then, put their head down and go back to eating, yeah.
Even the elk are like that. If you,
yeah,
if you're 300 yards away and you shoot an elk, the rest of them will look up, and I've seen them go right back to eating. The dead one laying there in the bunch kicking around, you know?
You know, and sometimes they'll bolt at the sound, but then they stop a little confused. I've seen them, you know, I've put an elk on the ground, and the elk's kicking, and they'll walk over there, and then the non-typical actions of that animal on the ground scare them worse than the sound or anything else, and they're just kind of startled at there's something odd going on here, and they'll move away.
And they do understand that something's different. Mm-hmm. You know, something's different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, some animals will eat their own, you know, like, yeah, some, maybe like a hog, that happens, and if you leave them alone, they'll start. So I guess animals are a whole different animal, so to speak.
So think of digger squirrels, Columbia ground squirrels here, okay? When I was a kid, you know, I don't do this anymore. I can't tell you exactly why, but I used to go out and shoot them just because it was so fun to shoot them. I mean, try to get the shot off accurately before they got back down in the hole, you know, provided some sort of a challenge. But you can shoot a squirrel, and when he dies there, somebody's going to come and drag him back underground and eat him. They will cannibalize that thing.
Another squirrel.
They are not much different than a rat, and rats are notoriously cannibalistic.
Yeah.
And so it's like, and cows are not much smarter. In fact, maybe not as smart as some rats, okay?
Probably not as smart as a rat, but I have come to appreciate that there is a little more thought process in a cow than I ever did years ago.
Well, do you see cattle, like if it's a calf that dies from, and the mother, is there like reactions that are relatable for a mother, you know, around a dead calf?
A cow will typically take 3 days to get over a dead calf.
And abandon the sight of a dead calf.
Right. In other words, like, she'll be in mourning? And
well,
what do you mean, like,
you
got to
define
days?
Mourning. Her mother instincts are such that she's going to stay there and work on that calf, try to lick him, try to get him up. Usually about 3 days.
Wow, that's a long time.
It's a long time. Night and day. Night and day. They will bawl all night. Right?
Well, yeah, but they'll come and go. They'll mm-hmm. they'll go eat and then they'll come back. They're not standing there mm-hmm. over the calf all that time.
Yeah.
What's it like in the big slaughterhouses where there's high stress and cattle have always lived in a cage? Clearly it's more high stress, but do you think it's different in any way when they're slaughtered there in terms of the animal's stress levels? And
I think it is. I think any time you interrupt a animal's daily routine and introduce something that's unusual,
yeah,
their stress level goes up. Well, when you put them in a pen and jack them around, especially if they're using hot shots and stuff, they're bound to get excited. When we kill an animal, they don't even know they're dead until they're dead.
Yeah. No adrenaline response at all.
Standing there, fat, dumb, and happy, and all of a sudden, they're yeah. done, you know. And you see them kicking, and they say, well, they're still alive. But that jerk response goes on for several minutes, and if you want to really find it out someday, just reach down and cut into that back leg and before she's got all that response out, because they'll kick your damn head off.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is just a nerve. It's the same as chopping the head off a chicken. I mean, which I have done plenty of times. You chop the head off a chicken, and if you're attentive to the condition of the meat, you hold it, the tips of the wings and both legs in one hand, hold it, restrain it on the ground until that thrashing stops, because they'll bruise themselves jumping around. Just that thrashing, the meat will be bruised. And it's the same thing in a large animal.
Yeah.
I've often wondered if it'd be the same thing with me. If somebody got a good clean headshot, if I would thrash on the ground like that, and I expect I probably would.
You probably would. With any of that bruising, though, once they're bled out, they don't bruise anymore.
Mm, right. Oh, right. Oh, the blood out.
Yeah. You can drag a carcass half a mile down the hill once it's bled out.
In terms of stress level for your cattle, it's literally no different than any other day. They come up to your truck to eat, and until they're dead on the ground, they don't even have a second to feel like their daily routine has been disrupted. Is that right?
No, it's like, here, what do you, hey, what do you got to eat here now, bud?
They're like, they're first in line. They're probably in a good mood, actually. They're ahead of the line.
They die hopeful. Okay, now that's not a bad thing right there. Maybe we all have that blessing.
Do you think that people, I have a friend in Arizona who keeps a few cattle, like I think like five or six, kind of as a hobby. I don't really know how he got into it. Is it something that if somebody has a couple acres, they can buy a calf and kind of learn some of these things? Or is it sort of like you need so much gear and equipment that kind of don't bother? It's not like a, not like
no,
a dog.
No, you don't need that much equipment. The biggest problem there is don't let your wife get attached to it.
Or your kids. Yeah. Problem. Yeah.
You can't eat poor Freddy, whatever his name is, you know?
Yeah. And I remember that as a kid getting kind of attached. And it's a weird disconnect between you're out there, you're feeding it milk out of a bottle and you're feeding it grain and you're petting it and maybe you're brushing it and then you've got it on your plate, you know, and you know, by about the time you add up, okay, the calf is gone, the cow is gone, the meat's in the freezer and now it's on my plate. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's a mental discipline for a kid to be able to, you know, proceed, or it was for me.
Being an absolute carnivore, I never had that disconnect.
Okay, now.
It was tear the heart out and eat it.
Now, your dad, you grew up in California. He didn't have a bunch of cattle. There was a milk cow. You told me a milk cow story.
We had cows. We had a few, you know, like Nate's talking about. There were three or four. There were goats.
Your dad had 40 acres?
No. The most he ever had that I was aware of when we were in Southern California was five.
5 acres, okay. So what did he kill and how did he kill it and did he process the meat?
Well, after I was about 10 or 12, I was the butcher.
Really? That's right. Your dad was a soft-hearted guy.
He came out of that war and he did not really want to kill anything.
World War One.
Yep.
Wow.
As tough as nails, hard rock man, but
capable man,
soft-hearted to the point that when a rabbit screamed and stuff, he just did not like it.
Interesting.
And I was the assassin.
Once it was on the ground, he could wade in and take the heavy work until you got strong enough to do it.
Yeah. He didn't like killing him.
I'll be darned.
I think you mentioned this in a video, but he never talked about the war. Is that right? Did he ever tell you like the nitty gritty of what that was like for him?
Not until just about the time he was dead.
Wow.
And the only thing he ever said was, I just don't know what's going to happen. We did such terrible things.
Left a big scar on him.
Yeah.
Big, deep scar.
Yeah. All those guys probably thought about that every day of their life. And man, what a burden.
What a burden.
But PTSD was never even thought of.
Nobody had coined that phrase.
Those guys came home.
Yeah.
They went back to work.
They got
a job. Their families.
They got married.
Yep.
They worked through it.
Yeah.
There was probably more like shame and like stigma if you did complain and act like it was this, you know, there was maybe a little more expectations to be a tough guy or a, you know, who knows what. They just kind of bury it down, whereas now there's maybe a little more encouragement to...
From what I've read, that the trenches in France were a really hellacious place to be.
They were the worst thing that had been on the face of the earth till that point. Dan Carlin. Yeah, his historical narratives about World War One, Blueprint for Armageddon, horrifying, that those guys would be in those trenches with the body parts of their comrades had been blown up, and they would scrape dirt down over they would bury them in the bottom of the trench because you couldn't get out to bury them. They would enlarge the trench to bury the guys they were walking on, and the bottom of the trench would become spongy, like a box springs, because they were, think of that. And then the flies,
Not only that is when they got out of the trenches to go to charge, if they fell off the planks into that mud, they were done.
In Flanders Field? Yeah. Man, he would tell, Carlin would tell these stories about coming back, making it across the planks and doing their thing and come back at night and going by their comrades who are up to their chest or their chin and had lost their mind because of the certainty of what was going to happen to them when they slipped under the mud and just had to go on back. And sometimes they would cap them on the way by. What kind of a scar would that leave? Unbelievable.
I know that it bothered Pop.
Yeah, you bet it did. You bet. So that was your introduction to home meat production. Did you ever not produce your own meat?
Not really. It wasn't a... We killed a few hogs, killed some pigs now and then, killed lots of chickens, rabbits, goats. Ate a lot of goat meat.
What's the point of rabbits on a farm?
Eat.
Just meat.
Like you would keep them and raise them in pens and like breed them for meat. It seems like such small meat on those things compared to a bigger animal.
Big rabbit weighs 5-6 pounds, you know.
That's a meal.
They are just a one-to-one analog to a chicken, just about.
They're very lean. I've been told and read that you can't live on rabbit meat, that it's...
Oh, really?
That it's
not
so,
enough fat?
That it's so lean that you can't...
Interesting.
Make it on it.
So when Kelly and I moved to Wyoming, we were 23, probably 23. Moved back there. Zero money. Borrowed the money to move. Amanda was born. She was pregnant with Nathan. Got back there. And there were cottontail rabbits everywhere, and I had 22 shells. I didn't have any money. So we ate a lot of rabbit. Wow. And a cottontail is little, like two of these cups. And there's a trick to field dressing them. You cut them down low, grab them by the front legs and the ears, whip them, and the guts just splatter out on the ground, so you never stick your fingers in there. You can grab the hide between your thumb and forefinger right in the middle of the back and pull, and the hide will tear, and the hide comes off like a sock in both directions. Pull the hide off and they're clean. You drop it in a plastic bag and keep hunting. So we ate a lot of cottontail.
We pulled the hide off most of the rabbits. You just cut them around the legs and then just pull it right off.
Slip right off, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. It is, you know, people who are opposed to eating meat, and it makes sense, you know, they're not interested in experiencing some of these things. Funny how fish kind of are. They're just they're cold. Their eyes don't look the same. And does anybody cry about killing fish? I don't think so. Even vegetarians eat fish. Okay. They love fish.
There are vegans, nothing with a face.
Yeah,
okay, nothing with a face. And I guess somewhere inside of me now, at age 61, I can think those thoughts. It was a long time before I could.
Why?
I have no reason why. I'm not saying I agree with the thoughts, but I can think the thought.
I have a very good vegetarian friend whom I've known for years. Years and years, and she was getting pretty sick. And the doctor told her, you have to start eating some animal protein. Uh-huh. And so she started eating some fish and some chicken, and she improved.
Got better.
Yes. Hmm. Now she still doesn't like meat or beef, but she eats the chicken and the fish.
Like that book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. We are omnivores.
Yeah.
Well, you would claim to be a carnivore. But I see you eat the occasional salad, right?
I do eat salad.
What about like fruit and nuts?
I eat fruit and nuts.
There you go.
But very little wheat products or anything with sugar in it.
Unless Maxine makes biscuits.
Well, actually, I ate 2 raw chocolate chip cookies this morning.
And there is the piece of apple pie.
There is that. I am occasionally known to do that, but 99% of my diet is meat, salad, fruit, nuts, cheese.
Yeah. And I'll say it's born pretty good fruit. I mean, so you are now 83.
Yes.
And it was 10 years ago, I think, that you grabbed that chin-up bar in my shop and did 10 chin-ups.
Yep.
Pretty good at age 73.
How many could you do right now?
Probably 10.
You want to try it?
You got one?
You could probably, actually probably wouldn't work. I was thinking those stairs, but maybe not.
Now, since then, here's the problem. Since then, you had that wagon wreck and tore the socket out of your shoulder. And then the other thing.
Both sides, actually.
Yeah, yeah, two different wagon wrecks. Tore both the sockets out of both your shoulders.
I got to qualify that, Nate. My chin-ups aren't completely hang down to the ground because they hurt.
They aren't Marine Corps.
I don't think anybody's going to worry about that. I'm certainly not.
We're not doing it. He has knives to make.
Back to hunting and animals for a sec. I heard Joe Rogan make a point explaining this to somebody. I thought it was really good. I had never thought of it regarding hunting, and that is these animals are going to meet a violent death one way or another.
That's right.
Especially wild animals like elk.
Unless they die of illness, aching, slow, worm-infested illness, break a leg and not get killed by a predator, how are you going to die? Shivering and shaking.
Exactly. Either way, it's a cold, tough world for these animals. And, you know.
And with the cattle, they have no other purpose. You know, we're not gonna run them out here and take care of them if they don't have an end purpose.
Yeah.
You know, they're not pets. They're not, we're not gonna.
Yeah.
No.
Well, it's great that people can live however they want to live. And if people don't want to involve themselves, they're more than welcome to not eat animal products. And
that's fine.
Fine by us.
You know, it's so interesting, but I will assert that it's only in this age now. So with you as a possible exception, very few people alive in the United States today have ever experienced any real fearful deprivation that wasn't somehow related to somebody else's actions or an addiction. Or what I'm saying is the modern world has taken the fear of imminent death away that everybody lived with all the time up until, what, 60 years ago?
Not
80
only
years
that,
ago?
It's taken the fear of starvation away.
That's kind of what I'm getting to.
Yeah.
A vegan lifestyle can only exist in a world where nutrition is everywhere, yeah. Where food is relatively cheap, and there is always a way to get not only something to eat, but what you want to eat.
Choice.
Choice is now part of our diet to an unprecedented degree. And so veganism and vegetarianism can be something that's prominent.
Yeah.
But if
but why?
If the preppers are ever right, if the preppers are right and the grid goes down, the vegans are going to be the first to relish a bite of partially cooked over of raw meat if they can get their hands on it. Okay, there comes a time when you're glad to have something to eat.
I think everybody's still only a hair's more like 4 days away from being there.
That's right.
I read that book Adrift, the guy in the 70s who got, you know, his sailboat sank and he floated across the Atlantic, and he was eating the scales and the eyeballs, and it was like the happiest moment of his life to have a fish on board that he caught like with his hands. And other stories of people in survival situations where all of us would instantly like be feeling and willing to eat literally anything,
even possibly cannibalism.
Well, no, undoubtedly, right, those guys in South America in the 70s, guys.
Yeah.
And the Donner Party.
Exactly. Yeah.
In
there.
The Thin Air, isn't that the name of the book?
Alive.
Alive. Yeah. It would be a sore temptation.
Well, you're not all that far from an animal.
That's right. We share certain characteristics,
don't we? Hunger is a powerful motivation.
Yeah. In fact, I was struggling with that on the way out here. Do I pull over and buy that donut or not? No, I will not. My stomach will not dominate me this moment.
There's no doubt that people from cities and who've grown up in an urban lifestyle, it really is foreign and kind of shocking. And with YouTube and being able to see these things firsthand, mm-hmm. I got to admit, it would be easy to kind of, you know, it would be a... It could be kind of a shock. I think for some people, it's not a big deal. For other people, it's like, holy smokes, that is evil.
Maybe
if you got dropped out of right into it out of a helicopter, evil, maybe it would look that way.
Evil's a pretty strong word.
It is.
But, well, there's people who would call it that and defend themselves.
But again,
yeah. I know it's a little weird.
Give them 2 weeks and hunger and we'll see.
What was it like as a kid? I mean, the world was a lot different back then, even in terms of food production. It took a lot of work to make a meal when you didn't have a microwave. So even when you were a kid, it was a little different, right? Or did it kind of feel the same way? There was abundance and,
other than a little bit of rationing during the Second World War, and then only a few things were hard to come by, butter. That was a thing that was a little hard to come by. We had oleo.
Mm-hmm. Oleo margarine.
But oleo came white because they couldn't dye it yellow. Because
the dairy lobby.
Because of the dairy lobby. But it had little capsules of yellow food dye in it. Hmm. And some of them, you could break the capsule inside this plastic pouch and then squeeze it until it mixed it up.
Cool.
I can remember doing that. But I never have, aside from being in the mountains a couple times when I was out overnight and hadn't prepared for it, I've never really been hungry. And that's a very short duration of hunger.
Yeah.
But you get pretty damn hungry.
And you knew it was going to come to an end.
Right.
There was food waiting.
Right.
All you had to do was get there.
Yeah, I had to get back in the cabin. Yeah.
Was your dad a kid in the Great Depression?
He wasn't a kid, but he was a young adult with a family.
So how did the older generation talk about the Great Depression in terms of, you know, right now a lot of older generations talk about millennials and Zoomers and like, oh, you kids don't know what a hard life is like. Did Great Depression survivors like carry that through to your generation and hold it against you or not really?
I think so. I think I can remember him saying I'd go out and I'd try to find a job for anything.
Mm-hmm. Any job.
Right. For anything. Mm-hmm. You know?
Any money at all.
Right. Mm-hmm. 50 cents, a buck a day, whatever it paid, I'd take it. Of course, my sister was born by then. My little brother probably came right along towards the end of it, but he didn't live very long. But that was right during the early 30s. And
holy smokes. Mm-hmm. Man, your dad really kind of got the short straw on generations in terms of the small family and the Depression. Talk about stress. World War I, it's obvious.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he had some hard times.
Yeah, but he was doing anything he could, and that was the way it was.
There was no welfare net.
Well, there was soup kitchens. There were places where somebody could get a meal once in a while. But he was working. He was digging wells, hand digging wells. When he got hurt really bad, a guy dropped the bucket on him.
So let's flesh that out a little bit. Hold your thought about your dad. What we're talking about here is hand digging a hole in the ground and going down on the bottom of the hole, and there would be a rope run down off a little derrick, a little kind of a
Mickey a couple Mouse. Hundred feet.
Down 200 feet, you're in a hole in the ground of your own making, no OSHA shoring, you're down in the hole, and the bucket comes down a couple hundred feet, and you fill it with dirt, and it goes up, and at a certain point, the rope breaks.
No, the guy was drunk and he dropped.
Okay, so he hit freewheel on the derrick and dropped the bucket full or empty?
I don't know that.
A bucket fell 200 feet down a cylindrical hole in the ground and there's a man at the bottom. That's going to hurt you.
Well, they put him in the hospital. They sent him down to Southern California to the hospital at University of California. And they put him back together and while he was down there recuperating, he met my mother.
Really?
Oh.
And she decided that, they decided to get married and she would continue teaching school and he would go to school and get his education.
So that's so interesting that he went the education route following interesting. So my mom and dad connected when he was laying in a hospital bed after cutting his left foot almost off in a motorcycle wreck.
Yeah.
Convalescence is a time for budding romance, I guess, right?
So young listeners, you need to get out there and just break yourself.
Yeah, just some sort of little accident.
No, don't.
In the hospital.
It hurts too bad later on.
So he ended up teaching school.
Yes.
And one of the, so speaking, Nate, to your observation about the emotional trauma, that what was your dad's name?
Searle.
That Searle, yeah, that's right, okay. That Searle endured. Through his middle age as a school teacher, he started taking boys, specifically boys who had issues, to a camp in the mountains as a way to sort of do something really worthwhile. And it was worthwhile. And he brought you in on that on the front end of when you were about the same age as the boys that he was interacting with?
Or a little younger.
Okay.
Like troubled youth, like boys who are getting in trouble?
He taught in the Los Angeles juvenile hall.
Oh, okay. So maybe students that he bumped into or kids he met at the juvenile hall who needed extracurricular help.
They were.
It was part of the program, maybe.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
He took them to the mountains, and later on he worked for the Masonic home down there because the guy that was running that juvenile program went over to run the Masonic home, and Pop went along with him for the summer camp, and he ran summer camps.
Huh.
For kids there.
Pretty neat.
Yeah.
Did he go by Cy or he went by Searle?
He went by Cy.
Mm-hmm. In general terms, you had your father's approval growing up. He wanted you to pursue an education.
I had my father's approval until I wouldn't go to college.
Right, right. And then you had it until you decided to be to hang glide when you had a family of your own and you were in your 40s and hang gliders were new and dangerous and you had to have one. And he was pissed.
To put it mildly, we had very few really bad arguments. Very few, vaguely none. But he was so incensed at me for being that irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. He was right.
How do you feel looking back at that? You know, you can. I'm sure you could see his point of view at the time. But what are your thoughts on it now?
Nate, I had the absolute conviction I was immortal.
Yeah. Nothing would kill him. Until you were how old?
Hell, I don't know, 50, 60 years ago.
When I met you 15 years ago and it finally dawned on you.
I'd come through so many bad wrecks with Harley scratches and a few broken bones and stuff that... My kid told me once, "Dad, I never worried about you flying that thing." He said, "I didn't think anything could hurt you."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
And you cemented that by falling 40 feet out of the air when your kid's second grade class came over to watch you fly.
It was closer to 60.
60, right? And you stalled and bounced down through the oak trees and got to the ground.
You are putting on like a demonstration or something for the class?
Oh, my little girl's class wanted to come out and watch me fly the hang glider.
Okay.
Well, Gallagher Mountain's up there about 2,500 feet behind the house. And I took off up there, and I had a really, really good flight. And I came down to the landing area, and I probably had close to 1,000 feet of bonus air.
Okay.
Okay, pause. And the class, the kids are out in the middle of the field watching you do this.
Right.
Okay.
Do you mean bonus air? You're 1,000 feet higher than you needed to be, the landing zone. Okay.
Than I usually was.
Okay.
So I made a mistake. I turned and went downwind and turned out over the forest there across the road. And when I turned back towards the landing field, I was getting down air and I knew I'd made a mistake.
Downdraft. You caught a downdraft.
It wasn't just a downdraft. I was no longer getting any lift out of it.
Oh, you're falling.
And I wasn't going to make it. So I picked the spot that had the least amount of trees in it, heading for the field, and I headed for that. Well, I caught an ash tree up about 50, 60 feet off the ground with the left spar on the hang glider, and it folded it up.
Wow.
And I fell down through, and it wasn't a direct fall because I've got the kite, and it's kind of hung up, and...
Oh, well, in that case.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't like I plummeted 60 feet out of the air.
But you worked your way to the ground in a vanishing kite.
And I ended up kind of scraping myself in the fence a little bit that was in the trees. But
wow,
it wasn't bad.
So it turns out you were actually right all along. You are pretty much immortal and survived all these things. So I guess... you wouldn't change your tune to your dad at all.
16 major reconstructive surgeries. That's got to be some kind of a record. Some of them voluntary, like the two knees that you had put in.
Yeah.
Two knees at the same time.
I think it's a little more than that now.
Yeah, 16 or 18 reconstructive surgeries.
Anyhow, it's...
Shotgun blast, all of it. Can you think of anything that comes to mind that where, from the time you were a kid until now, you've had any really significant changes in perspective? Of any kind, anything, or do you think that if you could talk to your 20-year-old self, you guys would be seeing De Acuerdo on every topic?
No, because I've softened a lot. Uh-huh. I have more tolerance.
Would you go so far to say it's empathy?
Define empathy.
Empathy is an ability to feel others' pain.
I may not feel, well, maybe a little, but I can honor their viewpoint more.
Mm-hmm. That kind of tolerance, yeah. Willing to accommodate.
Whereas before, hit the road, you know. In my way. We don't do that.
Yeah.
You know, but I've come to the conclusion that I'm not always right.
Okay, now that is a worthwhile paradigm shift.
Right.
I've yet to make it.
Well, you know, some people, especially when you're young and they have this idea, and I have friends that are in their 75 and 80 years old that still think they're right no matter what.
Yeah.
What a shame. And it makes life really difficult for them.
Yeah, you know, every two-year-old thinks they're always right. And the hope is that gradually we get past that and realize we don't have to believe everything we think, all right?
Well, it took me 60 years or so.
Do you think guys are more likely to get set in their ways as they age, or more likely to get bigger perspective the way you have as they age? Or is it just everybody's different and so?
I think everybody's different, and I think it has to do more with your parents and how you were raised than anything else. You know, you can't escape your early parenting. It's there. It's going to affect you. I had a great set of parents. Hmm. They had a child development plan. You know, it was we're going to push this kid and give him all the opportunity we can. And we're going to put everything in the way that we can to make him a broader person. My dad bought me a set of tools when I was 6.
Wow.
And I've still got some of them. But he gave me a carburetor. Now, this is a hell of a toy, especially for somebody that wanted his child to become educated.
He didn't realize he was slamming the door to higher education.
He just...
And having you butcher the cattle, it's like, what does he think's going to happen?
He stepped on his own foot, really, because he gave me tools. He gave me little motors to take apart. He gave me this carburetor. I played with it. I could take it apart in my sleep.
Wow.
You know? Took it apart, put it together, took it apart, put it together.
Huh.
I had stuff like that all the time. Of course, it's a simple carburetor in those days. You know, it's not very tough. He was a horse trader, and I say horse trader because he traded anything, everything. Hmm. He brought home more varied stuff than you can imagine.
5 acres of stuff.
Stuff. And literally, it was had alleyways going through it.
Wow.
But there were model airplane engines. I took them apart. I put them together. I took them apart. I got some of them to run. You know, it was... Hell, by the time, when I was 14, he bought me a Model A Roadster, a 1931 Model A Roadster that had been in a wreck. He paid $15 for it.
Hmm. And did your mom see on the horizon that this is going to turn my kid into a 17-year-old driving his Model T 95 miles an hour and wrapping it around an oak tree? They did not connect the dots to that outcome.
I don't think they did. I tore that Model A apart. I scoured the junkyards, which were very prominent in those days, and full of Model A parts for nothing, you know.
Yeah.
I got a bell housing. I got a front end. I had that thing up on blocks and hung from a pepper tree limb and rebuilt the engine. And
wow.
I had it running really good.
It's probably like parenting 101, but this is a good example. And when you tell a kid they can do something, or when they learn that at a young age, I can fix and solve things, and they have the approval to do so, it seems like that's the same mindset you carried. We talked about the lake development, which was a feat of strength, and I'm sure there's 100 other stories, and I know there's kids who have parents who are kind of clamping down on them. You can't do that. You don't know how. And talk about like the magic key to, you know, being a productive adult is having that confidence from good parents. When you were 6, I guess, is when you first started.
Pop told me,
getting that,
you can do anything.
There you go.
You can do anything. You can be anything. You can do anything. His other big thing was being responsible and leaving the world a better place.
Wow.
Those are terrific values.
What a great father. I'm sure your mother has had her own, like, equally impressive influence.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it until later.
We never do.
But she was super strong in her own way.
I love Orson Scott Card as an author. And one of the quotes that means the most to me, and I think is most useful generally, is that mothers give milk and fathers give approval. And then after that, he went on to say that a child has to have both those things to thrive. And, you know, of course, obviously that's speaking to spiritual or physical and intellectual and emotional and spiritual nourishment, you know, coming from the two sides of the yin and the yang, yin and the yang, staff, distaff and the spear, however that's phrased. But you got it from those people. Do you feel you and Maxine passed that on?
I think to an extent, yes. Maxine's a very strong, organized, capable person.
Yeah.
She better organized than I am.
Orders of magnitude. Okay, that's the understatement of the interview. She is organized.
She gets a tremendous amount of work done. She's already mailed 130 some Christmas cards, you know.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, here we are the 6th of December or 7th, and she's mailed 137, I think you told me this morning,
yeah.
Christmas cards, each with their own little note. Maybe
wow.
A letter.
Some of them a letter. You know, and besides that, she's raked the leaves in the yard and mowed the grass and
and just paid the bills and every other thing.
She's just a dynamo, but unfortunately she's getting a little old. She gets tired now.
Just as mortal as the rest of us.
All right, well, we'll wrap it up here. Thanks for coming and talking with us, Si. It's really neat. And you guys are absolutely going to want to click to YouTube on this. We actually have some footage of Si, if you're okay with us using it, of you flying your hang glider. I don't know when that was taken, but some family videos.
A long time ago.
Back when you were immortal.
So we've got the proof. Unfortunately, we don't have the picture of him rolling out of a tree, but maybe he'll do that again for you.
We'll mock that up.
Yeah, we'll
be your own stuntman.
All right, so check it out on YouTube. This will be on our main channel, and we really appreciate you listening, and we'll catch you next time.